The original podcast was recorded in German. This podcast was translated using artificial intelligence. Burn Rate, the Venture Insider podcast with Max Meister.
Hello and welcome to Burn Rate, the VC Insider podcast. I'm speaking with Guy Giuffredi about the startup scene with a focus on venture capital. This is episode 80, so we've hit a small anniversary. We're recording on Wednesday, January 28th at 9 p.m. This podcast is sponsored by our partners Omnium and Upscaler.ch. Guy, small anniversary, great stuff. What are today's topics?
Yes. For this small anniversary episode, we've prepared some exciting topics. In the news, we'll give a short update on the ETH Deep Tech Summit. Then we'll cover the first closing of the new VI Partners Fund and the final closing of B2B Fund. After that, we'll discuss findings from a PitchBook analysis showing that Switzerland is among the leading nations globally when you look at VC investment per capita. Very exciting. In the main topic, we'll look at the waterfall in an exit, meaning how is the sale proceeds distributed? The listener question is about zombie VCs, and to wrap up, we'll highlight the most interesting transactions of the week in the Swiss ecosystem.
You were at the Deep Tech Summit in Zurich this week. Can you summarize your key takeaways for us?
Yes, happy to. Overall, I thought the Deep Tech Summit was extremely well organized. There were more than 1,000 participants and 100 spin-offs from ETH, EPFL, PSI, and EMPA spread across multiple floors in ETH's main building. Big compliments to the ETH and UBS organizers. It was really well run. It was easy to connect and exchange, and for once there were actually enough standing tables for conversations. Content-wise, the level was very high, with strong voices like Klaus Hommels, Fiona Murray from the NATO Innovation Fund, and many others sharing their perspective on how deep tech startups scale, where capital truly has impact, and where the most important technology trends are heading. At the same time, the summit showed impressively how strong the Swiss deep tech pipeline currently is. There were many ETH and EPFL spin-offs on site, from AI and robotics to life sciences, energy, and advanced materials. I had shorter conversations with some teams and longer ones with others, and the founder conversations felt notably mature. Many teams are already thinking early about industrialization, scaling, and international markets, even shortly after founding. The bar is clearly higher than it was a few years ago. It's no longer just about moving a technology from the lab to a first customer. Teams are making clear statements about the market. They have LOIs, POCs, or even first customers, and can convincingly explain why they're positioned to win. Unfortunately, I was only there for one day. It ran Monday and Tuesday. Otherwise, I would have loved to go deeper with more teams.
You also attended the investor soiree in the evening. What was the vibe like?
That was a good event as well, and hosted at UBS on Bahnhofstrasse. There were more than 300 investors there. Lucas Reinhardt from UBS told me they even had to turn many investors away because demand was far too high. What I want to highlight? International investor interest was extremely strong. A lot of international players were present at the soiree as well. From Switzerland, basically every relevant VC was there, of course, and I spoke with them, but I also focused specifically on international VCs. Among others, the family office 11Z from Dieter Schwartz, the little founder, who also strongly supports ETH. They want to do much more in Switzerland, and I explicitly appreciate the Swiss approach, if you want to call it that. Deep technical substance, no overpromising. Apparently in Germany, overselling has become somewhat of a trend. I also connected briefly with Atlantic Labs, Joint Capital, and many others. Overall, it was very clear international players are actively looking for access to the Swiss deep tech ecosystem. That's why it's important for us to stay deeply anchored locally while also networking internationally so we can pool and syndicate investors effectively. The investor mood was almost surprisingly positive. That said, some people in the Swiss ecosystem were also quite critical about the development of early stage deep tech valuations, saying if this continues, it'll become almost impossible to invest. That's definitely a critical point and something we discuss and debate often. And one last point about the summit and the investor soiree on behalf of Burn Rate. Many people I spoke with listen regularly, startups and investors alike. Thank you for tuning in and for all the positive feedback. That really made me happy.
You mentioned valuations, right? I had dinner yesterday with an American investor who lives in London. She was at the WEF for several events. And by the way, she was also at the Deep Tech Summit. And she confirmed it. She said Swiss valuations are far too high. That was her statement. And I find that remarkable. We're currently looking at our first investments at Koyo and a lot of things we just can't do because this is insane, frankly, what people are asking for. And most people probably don't know this. After university, I worked at and also co-founded a valuation firm. And I spent my days looking at IP valuations. So I look at this very critically. When I see startups with zero revenue, zero recurring revenue, and even if they had some revenue, it might be one thing. But then they ask for a 60 million Swiss franc valuation. From a pure VC math perspective, it's almost impossible to invest. Unless it's a king-making round, investors commit so much capital that they basically push these startups into becoming category leaders, leaving almost no other outcome than success. And that does exist. I recently spoke with a founder of a well-known Swiss startup who said, "If you'd asked me 2 years ago whether today's recurring numbers would be realistic, I would have said never ever." That shows what happens when you have the right investors who see the potential and effectively turn you into a top startup. Then these valuations can, in some cases, be justified. But for us, that doesn't make it easier. We have to think, what is the market's absorption capacity? Is there still room for the market to develop? And the startup needs to end up among the winners. Making that assessment isn't impossible, but it's very hard. Still, we enjoy the challenge and we're curious how the market and investments will develop. All right, let's move to the news of the week. In Switzerland, we had the closing of two funds and 300 million euros in new capital. Although to be precise, not everything is fully closed yet, not all of it is final close. B2B Venture announced the final close of Fund 5 at 150 million euros. That's the largest fund in the firm's 25-year history. That's pretty wild. 25 years. The focus is clearly pre-seed and seed. They're industry agnostic with around 35 investments across Europe, and they bring their well-known model, an active network of more than 350 angels, many of them successful founders from earlier funds. Second, Sixt Partners announced the first closing of a new 150 million euro fund. Important, first closing, not final close. Sixt Partners is positioned more in early growth and Series A, similar to Koyo, with a focus on tech and healthcare. Here as well, we see strong commitments from certain LPs, a clear trust signal in a market where fundraising is anything but trivial. We've seen that ourselves with Koyo. If you look at these two funds together, you can see the pattern clearly. Capital is still flowing, but very selectively. That was also our prediction for this year. B2B Venture is already far along. VI Partners still has to get to final close, but I'm confident they will. Two funds, two different stages, two different theses, but one shared message to the market. And I think that matters a lot. Guy, when you put B2B Venture Fund V and the new VI Partners Fund next to each other, what does that tell you about the current state of the VC market in Switzerland and Europe?
To me, it paints a pretty clear picture. We're not back in hype mode like 2020 and 2021, but rather back with the established players, professionals, investors who've raised multiple funds and have a track record. B2B Venture shows that early stage still works if you have deal flow, track record, and differentiation. In their case, clearly the angel network and their high investment frequency. With VI Partners, it's a bit different. It shows Series A remains financeable when LPS trust the selection, portfolio support, and the fund's thesis. And importantly, these aren't opportunistic funds. Both are investors with a long history. LPs are currently betting on experience and track record, not on experiments. And both funds also benefited from major exits last year and likely distributed capital back to LPs. They were in Nexthink and Ava/Aurora type unicorn cases. And I'm convinced that helped a lot with fundraising momentum. Max, what does that mean for founders? Good news or bad news?
That's almost a rhetorical question. It's good news for the right founders. What we're seeing is a clear phasing. Pre-seed and seed is addressed by funds like B2B Venture. And then we have funds that operate a bit later as well. That's positive for Switzerland because for a long time we had the issue that many funds only did pre-seed slash seed, and now it's shifting slightly later again. That creates more planning certainty for founders who want to progress cleanly through the phases, and they don't have to immediately orient toward Anglo-Saxon or international VCs. At the same time, it's become more demanding. Capital exists, but it goes primarily to teams with substance. Investors expect deep tech, strong execution capability, credible scaling. The era of broad spray and pray, like we saw from 2018 to 2022, is over. My conclusion is clear. We're in a flight to quality phase, and these two funds are a good mirror of that. Now, another piece of news that's remarkable for Switzerland. New PitchBook analysis, PitchBook belongs to Morningstar, shows that when you look at VC capital per capita, Switzerland is in the absolute global top group. This is almost never discussed, so we're covering it today. For comparison, the US in 2025 is at around $104 of VC investment per person, driven by AI mega deals like OpenAI or Anthropic. Singapore follows at around $76 per capita. And this is where it gets interesting. Switzerland is in the same league. Depending on definitions, it lands in the high double-digit USD per person and ranks among the global top countries, well ahead of large markets like Germany, France, or Italy. Crucially, these figures aren't driven by one-off mega rounds, but by a continuous high density of investments in deep tech, life sciences, robotics, and AI. For a country with about 9 million people, that's a very strong signal. PitchBook also shows that Europe now has multiple countries in the global top 10 for per capita VC funding, and Switzerland is one of the most stable and highest quality representatives. In short, if you don't only look at volume, but at capital intensity per talent, Switzerland is right at the top. And that's what I want to discuss with you briefly, Guy. What does it tell you? Switzerland at top level per capita, despite being a small market.
That's a strong statement. And to me, it's a very meaningful indicator for Switzerland. VC per capita shows where capital, talent, and technology really come together. And Switzerland delivers consistently. Not just in isolated moments, but structurally. Like you said, it's not a few mega rounds, it's many startups being funded across the board. That's a structural dynamic. And it also explains why international investors we saw Monday and Tuesday are increasingly searching specifically for Swiss deals, especially in deep tech, where a lot is happening right now.
Does that mean Switzerland will be a long-term winner in this more mature VC market?
I believe so. And of course, there's some hope in that too, but there are many signals pointing in that direction. In a market where capital becomes more selective, stability, research quality, and execution strength matter, and the per capita PitchBook comparison captures exactly that. Switzerland is small but extremely efficient, and that makes it one of the most attractive VC locations globally in the long run, in my view. At the same time, if we want to attract foreign capital, we should also try to mobilize more domestic capital via Swiss funds investing into Swiss ventures. That would give the ecosystem more stability and make it more resilient to geopolitical shocks. And it would keep more value creation in Switzerland instead of abroad.
Let's move to the third news item. I noticed a Wall Street Journal article pointing out a shift in the AI market. VC capital is no longer flowing only into products or platforms, but directly into pure research, so-called neo-labs, AI startups with no revenue, often no concrete product, sometimes not even a plan. That's pretty striking. The narrative behind it. Top researchers believe current models like ChatGPT or Claude are hitting technical limits. That's the hypothesis. The next big breakthrough supposedly won't come from more data or more compute, but from a new architectural idea. And now that research is being venture funded at multi-billion dollar valuations. For investors, it's a bet on extreme outcomes. If a lab achieves a breakthrough, it could become a new OpenAI with enormous market power. If it fails, there's nothing left. So it's highly binary. That drives high burn rates and brutal talent competition. We've seen that again recently. A big wave of people moving back to OpenAI from other startups, and also movement of researchers from academia into startups. In the past, as a researcher, you had to execute the idea at least to proof of concept before raising serious money. Today, you can raise 100 million just by being brilliant in a niche. So the question is, are we seeing a new innovation machine being born, or is this the peak of an AI bubble where hope matters more than business models? Is this visionary VC or a sign that capital has completely lost discipline?
If you remember what I just said, in Switzerland, the focus is moving in the opposite direction. Not, we have something cool in a lab, here's a few million, but teams with concrete plans for how they'll use capital and win the market. In the US, it's definitely visionary. And there's a belief that major technological leaps rarely come from clear roadmaps, but from tinkering, from exploration. That does require breaking with classic VC logic. We're a bit more traditional. We want to see where things are going and what the capital is for. Without product, without market feedback, without time pressure, and often with very few investor rights, control basically disappears. If the breakthrough doesn't happen, or teams become undisciplined, brilliant researchers who prefer research over product building, then it's ultra high risk. It's a bet on a one in a billion company, not maybe we'll build a unicorn because they already start at unicorn valuations.
Exactly. There's no fallback. If the thesis fails, that's it. But you're an investor. Why do investors accept multi-billion valuations with no revenue or even without a product?
The investors who do this strongly believe AI is a winner takes most or even winner takes all market, and they're afraid of missing the winner. That fear is greater than the fear of losing money. They've also raised massive mega funds in recent years and likely have too much capital they need to deploy. For them, one successful lab could justify the entire fund portfolio. So it's less classic calculation and more a strategic hedge against becoming irrelevant.
Do you want to scale your startup fast and successfully? Not just grow? Then the Upscaler program is exactly right for you. It gives you access to our large pool of founders, entrepreneurs, and the right investors. More than 50 startups have already benefited from over 500 workshops and scaled their business nationally and internationally. Want to benefit from personal, individual support as well? You can find all information at upscaler.ch. With Omnium, you close your funding round faster and more successfully. Our partner Omnium is an innovative growth financing platform. Omnium is the one-stop shop for funding rounds, a fully digital, lean, and cost-efficient process including legal framework, investors, KYC, and payment processing. If you raise on Omnium, you can choose a private round and simply use the platform for your investment opportunity. Or choose the private round plus access to 10,000 registered investors. If you want a high-visibility public round with broad reach, choose the public round where the offer is accessible to all investors. With Omnium, you close your funding round faster and more successfully.
Let's move to the main topic. Today, we're discussing an exit that perfectly shows how far private valuations and exit reality have diverged in recent years. Brex is being sold to Capital One for $5.15 billion, half cash, half shares. Sounds like a lot of money, but at the same time, it's clearly below the last private valuation of more than $12 billion from 2022.
That's exactly why we picked Brex. It's extremely interesting, not because it's a classic failure, but because it's a textbook example of how the waterfall works in practice. When an exit happens and money is distributed, how far down does the money flow in the cap table? Brex raised roughly $1.3 to $1.5 billion in VC capital over the years, including from heavyweights like Kleiner Perkins, Ribbit Capital, Green Oaks, Tiger Global, TCV, Y Combinator, and many more.
Before we go deeper into the exit, we should quickly explain what waterfall means in venture context. The waterfall simply describes the order and logic of how money is distributed in an exit. Who gets paid first? Who gets paid next? And who might end up with nothing. What matters isn't the last headline valuation, but the terms under which money was invested. Early investors usually hold common shares or cheaper preferred shares of lower seniority, Series A shares, Series B shares, Series C shares. Later investors often have liquidation preferences, contractual claims that ensure they get their invested capital back first in an exit. Concretely, in a sale, money flows first to those investors with liquidation preferences, often at least their invested amount, a 1x preference, sometimes a multiple. Only once those claims are satisfied do the remaining shareholders participate pro rata in what's left. That's why the waterfall explains how an exit below the last valuation can still avoid being a total loss, or why only half the capital comes back, and conversely, why a seemingly large exit can be disappointing for certain investors, employees, or even founders. In the end, the headline doesn't decide, the cap table structure does, and the details in the shareholder agreement determine who gets paid what, whether founders still get something, and whether early shareholders participate meaningfully.
And that's exactly the point. It's not a home run, but it's not a catastrophe either. It's a cleanly structured, safe landing. Capital comes back, employee options were likely repriced, so they aren't completely underwater, and the buyer isn't paying with fantasy equity. It's cash and liquid stock.
For founder Pedro Franceschi, it's a controlled end to an extremely ambitious journey. For the ecosystem, it's above all a reality check. Brex used to be on par with Ramp. Today, Brex sells while Ramp was last valued at $32 billion. That's painful emotionally, but analytically very interesting.
Brex shows very soberly, high private valuations are not a guarantee for high exits. The waterfall decides, not the headline.
If you look at the Brex waterfall soberly, from an investor perspective, is this a failed exit or a decent outcome?
It depends on when you invested. For early investors, there's still a very good upside. For later investors, especially those who invested at 1 billion plus valuations, it's an acceptable event under difficult market conditions. Overall, it's not a huge success in the classic VC sense. Early investors win meaningfully, late investors largely preserve capital, and that's the issue. Venture capital lives off asymmetric outcomes. An exit where a big part of the capital returns at 1x or 1.2x isn't enough to carry a fund given the risks elsewhere in the portfolio. Brex is not a total loss, not a fund maker, an okay exit, but only just acceptable. What does this exit say about the big growth rounds in 2021 and 2022?
We're back to the same theme. Valuations were simply too high back then. It wasn't fraudulent and not irrational in the moment. Those were the prices markets were willing to pay. But Brex shows very clearly. If you enter too late and too expensive, your return profile shifts from upside to capital preservation. You also said something interesting. Founders' options get repriced. That's always the big question. Over time, especially with massive rounds and king-making, founders can end up heavily diluted, maybe together holding 10% by Series C. And that's no longer attractive if you're working day and night and never took money off the table. What I've seen more recently, people use virtual shares. For example, a 10% phantom share pool for founders if they hit goals, or exit bonuses. An exit bonus can even be paid out in first rank before others get paid. That's one way to keep founder incentives fair. Long story short, the cap table alone tells you very little. That's the key lesson. Much more important is the shareholder agreement because it spells out exactly how the waterfall executes. That's where the music plays. And if you keep making concessions for each incoming round, don't be surprised if, even with 50% on the cap table, you only get paid out like 5% in reality. So founders, be careful. Get a good lawyer who understands this and protects you. Without founders, the company wouldn't exist. It can't be that founders end up with almost nothing while investors take 3x to 4x. It needs to be fair in the overall context. Of course, you should reward investors who took big risks. A 1x to 2x liquidation preference is fine. More than that becomes problematic. Guy, any comment?
One more tip for founders. If you're approaching an exit and you realize all investors have liquidation preferences and you feel uncomfortable because you'll get too little, talk to investors early. Put it on the table and say, guys, for us, this is not an attractive exit. What do we do? We won't push this forward. That helps you find a solution early. Everyone wants an exit, and sometimes you can structure it so founders still get a meaningful outcome. For a growth fund, a couple million less won't matter much. But for founders, a few million more is a huge difference.
Exactly. Early means not 5 days before the exit. If you do it then, people are pissed. You walk away, you might end up a bad lever and get nothing. Do it early, before you enter an M&A process. you have to understand your shareholder agreement. I'll be honest, when I was a founder, I read the agreement, but I didn't really grasp the implications. And I think many founders are in the same position. And that's bad. You really have to understand what it means and what the consequences are. Today, shareholder agreements are 40 plus pages. Understanding that is almost impossible without legal training. So, very important. And one more note, ChatGPT only helps to a limited extent. Uploading contracts and asking, where are the risks? We're still too early for that in complex cases. Same for Claude or Perplexity. Similar limits. There are specialized legal LLM tools that are further along, but still, be careful. Better to use an actual human being than software. It's worth it. Now to today's listener question from Rolf in Wettingen. He keeps hearing the term zombie funds and wonders what it means and whether it's temporary or structural in VC. Background. Sapphire Partners analyzed the US market and found over 10,600 VC firms. At the same time, the number of active funds dropped last year for the first time in over 10 years. Sapphire defines active as funds that have done at least one classic priced round in the last 4 years. Funds that don't do that are increasingly called zombie funds. They still exist formally, they manage their portfolio, they collect management fees, but they have no realistic path to raise fresh capital or make new investments. It's especially visible among younger funds and first-time managers who launched during the low interest rate era. Only a small fraction managed to raise Fund 2. Meanwhile, capital is concentrating more at large established funds. Guy, is the rise of zombie funds mainly a normal correction after the 2018 to 2022 boom? Or are we seeing a structural shakeout?
It's both, but the structural element is stronger in my view. VC has always been cyclical. In good times, many new funds emerge because capital is available and returns look good. What's new is that we're seeing an actual shrinkage in active funds for the first time in a long time. That suggests the market isn't just cooling, it's reorganizing. Many funds started in a world where capital was extremely cheap and exits felt almost automatic. That world doesn't exist anymore. Anyone without a clear track record, clear differentiation, access to the best deals, or a trusted anchor, LP, who commits a big chunk of the fund purely on trust, will find it extremely hard to survive.
What does that mean concretely for founders?
Founders feel it directly, even if they don't use the term. Zombie funds often decide extremely slowly, they're cautious to the point of paralysis, and they're barely able to do follow-on rounds. That makes fundraising less predictable. Founders need to look much more carefully at who they bring into the cap table. Not only does the investor have money, but do they have the institutional perspective to support the company long-term and a strategy to do so? A zombie VC might still deploy a last couple million, a last breath, but strategically they can become a burden, slow processes, collecting fees, little portfolio support, mostly administration instead of value add. That's dangerous. So founders, investors ask you a million questions and you have to open everything up. Do the same. Ask the questions you need to determine whether this is really the partner you want to marry until you sell the company. Max, can deals like the Brex exit help reduce the zombie fund problem?
Only to a limited extent. Exits like Brex matter because they create liquidity and show the market isn't dead, but they're not enough. Brex is an okay exit. Capital comes back, but it doesn't create big fund returns that make LPs euphoric. To truly reopen the market, we need more exits, higher multiples, and breadth, not just a few small outcomes. We need more funds that actually return money to LPs, DPI in our jargon. Only then will risk appetite return for new managers. Until then, consolidation will continue. One thing to note, first-time manager performance can actually be very strong because Fund 1 matters so much and GPs work extremely hard for it. But if you started in 2018 with Fund 1, you might still be underwater now. In year 7, you need to clear the hurdle, usually around 6% per year. And if you can't, then what's the point? That's provocative. But the reality is, our fixed salaries aren't amazing. we work for carry. If you realize in year six you won't clear the hurdle because the home runs won't happen, you'll look for new projects. You'll try to raise fund too. If that fails, you'll look externally. That's an inherent system problem. And fixing it will be hard. It'll require creativity. I'm curious how it evolves. Let's move to the transactions of the week. Last week, we saw some exciting deals again, and we'll summarize the most important ones. Let's start with the $220 million mega round of digital health scale-up Oviva. Oviva is based in Zurich and was founded in 2014 as an ETH spin-off, a classic Swiss healthcare case with strong academic roots. The founders, Kai Eberhard and Manuel Baumann, focused early on evidence-based medicine and integration into specific healthcare systems. Today, Oviva is one of Europe's leading providers of digital care for obesity and other chronic diseases, with a clear focus on reimbursement-based markets. You can see that academic origin clearly in the financing history. Early on, specialized health tech VCs like Earlybird and F-Prime came in, investors who specifically seek scientifically grounded models. In the growth phase, long-term investors like Temasek and Sofina joined, helping Oviva scale internationally and embed itself regulatorily in Germany, the UK and Switzerland. It's a clean cap table evolution.
Exactly. And now the Series D is $220 million. The round is led by Kinnevik, investing about $100 million. Existing investors Temasek and Sofina also participated. New investors include Planet First Partners, AP Müller Holding, Norsken VC, Lunate and EGS Beteiligungen. A new Swiss investor joining a Series D. That's great growth capital from Switzerland. It's a clear long-term growth capital strategy, not a classic VC syndicate anymore.
What's the game plan? Strategically, the money is used to roll out an already working model. Oviva has treated more than 1 million patients, has been cash flow positive since 2025, and operates fully reimbursement-based in its core markets. With the fresh capital, they want to expand into additional countries, address new conditions like hypertension and type 2 diabetes, and further deepen their AI-driven platform. This is less a bet on will it work and more an acceleration of an already established European champion.
Let's go to the Roman D Tech 5. They already operate internationally and were founded in the early 2000s. They focus on mission-critical identity infrastructure for governments and enterprises with longer sales cycles. This is not a classic university spin-off, but a commercially built tech company with strong GovTech DNA. Over the years, Tech 5 has positioned itself globally and is now live in several countries, especially where governments are rebuilding digital identity and payments infrastructure.
Tech 5 develops a full biometric and digital identity platform, from contactless biometric capture and multi-biometric matching to secure issuance and authentication of digital identities. The core is their digital public infrastructure platform, which they call Tech 5 Omnitrust, clearly designed for governments, banks, and telcos, not consumer apps.
And they're definitely not a PowerPoint case anymore. Tech 5 with Omnitrust has been rolled out in multiple countries, Honduras, Papua New Guinea, and Ethiopia. Many more pilots are running in other markets. The customer set clearly shows that digital public infrastructure has strong tailwinds right now, especially in countries rebuilding systems from scratch.
Interesting is how they financed further growth, not via a classic equity round. Tech 5 secured several million dollars in non-dilutive growth capital from Salika Investments. Salika is a London-based VC/private equity hybrid focused on venture debt and growth financing. For Tech 5, that means growth capital without cap table dilution, a strong signal that the model is already cash flow and project-based viable.
Yes, and when we talk venture debt, if things don't work out and the capital or interest can't be repaid, the contracts often have a pretty heavy catch. You need to watch that carefully because the debt provider can suddenly end up controlling the company and potentially take it over cheaply. With the capital, Tech 5 wants to accelerate international expansion into additional countries and large government projects. For me, it's a strong example of European GovTech, scaling not through hype, but through long-term contracts and infrastructure relevance. That's likely why they didn't choose a classic growth equity financing here.
Let's go to Zurich and talk about Sparkly. Sparkly was founded just last year and is not a university spin-off. The founding team consists of three former Google managers led by CEO Luc Poggiari. I hope I pronounced that correctly. It's clearly an edtech case with a strong AI focus, targeting children aged 5 to 12, and they've just come out of stealth. At launch, they closed a $5 million pre-seed round, which is a strong statement for that stage in Switzerland, especially in education.
They're building an AI-based learning platform that doesn't focus on frontal teaching or quizzes, but on curiosity and self-driven exploration. Children can create interactive learning expeditions on almost any topic within minutes, age-appropriate, visual, and playful. The goal is to move away from passive consumption toward active discovery. Technologically, Sparkly combines generative AI with pedagogy, gaming mechanics, and motion design embedded in a deliberately restrictive, child-safe product design.
On the investor side, the round is led by Founderful. Who else? Also interesting is their early market proximity. Sparkly is validating the product in a pilot with one of the world's largest private school groups. That gives them direct access to more than 100 schools and over 100,000 students, an extremely strong test environment for a product that needs to work didactically.
With the capital, Sparkly mainly wants to scale the generative learning engine and prepare the private beta launch. Midterm, the platform should evolve from pure curiosity to real creation, enabling children to build and prototype projects directly in Sparkly. The vision is ambitious. Sparkly wants to become the AI-native operating system for child development, tackling a market that's huge but has remained surprisingly static technologically, even though many companies have tried to bring more tech into it in various ways.
That's it for Burn Rate, the VC Insider podcast. If you want to support our podcast, subscribe to our newsletter and share it with your network. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. Take care and bye.